Coming up next on RCR, it's the dialogue with Dewa De Boer from politics.
So we sort of have a crossroads, as it were, here in New Zealand.
To power.
You know, when good men stand up, the spines of others are stiffened.
And culture.
Through times like this, you know, through adversity, you can see who you can trust, who you can rely on. You see who's standing with you, and all of these things are very, very valuable.
Tune in on Fridays, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
It is good to be back. Good afternoon. Another week has passed on RCR, and here we are at the tail end of it on The Dialogue. I am your host, Dewa De Boer, and this afternoon we are going to talk a little bit more about the British Empire with author John McLean from Tross Publishing. We'll cover a great battle from Canada this time. We have a few items of feedback from last week, which I will spread through the show as relevant this morning instead of putting them at the end. And we'll also listen to some classical music, and we will have the usual weekly roundup of news and other events with William McGimpsey, where we'll talk about everything that's happened, well, not everything, but some things that have happened in New Zealand and abroad. And as always, we'll have a little bit of New Zealand history before the end of the show. I realized that I missed the opportunity to play Vivaldi's Winter at the beginning of the month, seeing we're halfway through, well, not quite, but getting close to halfway through June already. But I do think I will hold it for next week, because next Friday is the 21st, which is the winter solstice. I think that will be a good opportunity for that. The shortest day, the true depth of winter. So we'll do that. And the week after that, we also have the official Matariki public holiday. I still think it's a missed opportunity to not tie that more closely to the winter solstice and why New Zealand is missing traditional winter festivities through these darker months. And a new holiday with little national significance is unlikely to make a real difference to that problem. But maybe we will talk a little bit more about that in a week or two. Let me know your thoughts. First, let's listen to a short romantic piece of music composed by Edward Elgar called Salut d'amour, Love's Greeting, composed for his wife as an engagement present. Elgar is considered to be the finest English composer of the early 20th century, and Salut d'amour is played here by cellist Yo-Yo Ma, one of the more famous cellists of the present day. I'm sure you've heard his name before. And we'll be right back after this with author John McLean to speak about his new book, The British Empire, A Force for Good. Welcome back to The Dialogue with your host, Dewa De Boer. We were going to have a chat with author and historian John McLean, but unfortunately, we have had some technical difficulties with his call. So while we try and sort that out, I thought we would play a short piece by Ralph Vaughan Williams from his English folk song suite at 17 come Sunday.
We live in a world where politicians and the media and the dominant culture is to slice and dice us and divide us. What I love about RCR is it brings us together, joins us up, makes us feel part of something bigger than us, and builds this great human connection.
Within 2 weeks of my having a show on RCR, we had journalists from the legacy media begging the Prime Minister to cancel RCR. That's how used to suppressing the truth the legacy media have become. That's how quickly we can make a difference. They failed to cancel me, they failed to cancel RCR.
It's all about freedom in the end. Freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of travel, medical freedom, freedom to bring up your own family as you see fit, freedom to say the climate crisis is a scam, freedom to say that the transgender movement is sinister, freedom.
It's absolutely vital we keep this narrative going, because certainly the other side, the alarmist side, is really amping it up. I just find using climate and everything around climate, that was quite funny, really, wasn't it?
We are here to really transform the shape of what media is going forward, which is such an honor and such an exciting stage to be in.
You've got to have both sides of the story. And that's what we're here to do.
We want to have these conversations. We want to be able to talk about this stuff. We want to be able to say the things that you guys are saying to yourself in whispered conversations in case someone else might hear at the supermarket.
Here, what we get is a checking of reality. And checking out reality is the very essence of our mental health and our survival.
Taking part in conversations and discussions to help find resolutions for the issues of today. This is The Dialogue with Diwa Dabor.
Now, unfortunately, we are unable to get John McLean on the line, so we're going to move ahead to something that John and I would have talked about.
A pivotal battle for the Empire in what is now known as Canada, with the British against the French. And it is perhaps the only great battle of history that could be said to be fought in Canada. And so it is one that I have selected to cover on today's show, as usual, adapted from Nigel Cawthorne's Masterstrokes of War. And the year is 1759. Britain and France are struggling for control of North America, but in this astonishing outflanking maneuver by General Wolfe, as he scaled the Heights of Abraham and took Quebec, established British title in Canada and drove out the French. With the 7 years' war raging in Europe, France could do very little to protect its colonies in North America. The British were determined to seize them. So in February 1759, 32-year-old General James Wolfe returned from sick leave in England to command the attack on Quebec and the St. Lawrence. First, he assembled a force in Nova Scotia, which the British had captured 2 years prior, and then he set sail for St. Lawrence. This took the French by surprise. They'd been expecting attacks from Lake Champlain to the south and Lake Ontario to the west, where the British had organized diversionary actions. The French commander-in-chief of Canada was the Marquis de Montcalm. He was one of their most able generals, and he had forced the British to surrender at Oswego 4 years prior, returning the control of Lake Ontario to the French. And just a few years prior, he had defeated a force of 15,000 men under General James Abercrombie with just 3,800 of his own troops. Montcalm assembled 5 regular French battalions, militia, and 1,000 Indians at Quebec, which sits on a rocky heartland that rises hundreds of feet above the confluence of the St. Lawrence and the St. Charles Rivers. The city was heavily fortified. Montcalm was convinced that any attack would need to come from the east, because the French navy maintained that the St. Lawrence was not navigable beyond Quebec. So he built trenches and gun emplacements to the east, which ran along the north bank of the St. Lawrence between the St. Charles and Montmorency rivers. Montcalm had 14,000 men and 106 guns to defend his position. General Wolfe arrived with 8,500 soldiers and occupied the Île d'Orléans on the south of the river, in opposite to Montcalm's riverside entrenchments. Also, a battery was deployed opposite the city. So on the 31st of July, Wolfe attempted an assault across the river. It was repulsed, producing around 500 casualties. Plainly, this was no way to defeat Montcalm. However, the Royal Navy came to the rescue. Among the naval contingency were some talented navigators, including James Cook, who later found his fame in the South Seas, discovering many of the Pacific Islands and, of course, charted New Zealand. And so over the next few weeks, these British ships, including James Cook as navigator, managed to pass by the French batteries, proving that the river above the city was navigable. The navy could now prevent supplies from reaching the French, and Montcalm now feared a landing to the west of the city, so he increased his patrols in that area. If Wolfe was to defeat the French, he had to draw them out from behind their defences so that they would face him on a wide, flat battlefield. The only available place were the Plains of Abraham, which ran right up to the city walls of Quebec from the west. The only problem is that it stood on top of a cliff. However, it was then discovered that a path ran up to the top of the cliff from a small bay. So while a diversionary attack was made on Montcalm's fortifications each of the city, those of Wolfe's men that were camped along the Montmorency River were carried at night, by a longboat past the sieged city. A sentry on the banks noticed the dark shapes of the boats moving up the river and cried out, "Quevi?" And excuse my French pronunciation, it was one of the subjects I failed in high school, so I'll do my best. And Captain Donald MacDonald answered in faultless French, "La France." "Qui regiment?" asked the sentry. "De rien," said MacDonald. It was one of Bougainville's units. It worked. In the boats, Wolfe recited Thomas Gray's elegy written in a country churchyard, published 8 years earlier, and said that he would rather have written that poem than take Quebec. However, his final speech to the assault troops put iron into their souls. "A vigorous blow struck at this juncture may determine the fate of Canada," he said. "The officers and men will remember what their country expects from them, and what a determined body of soldiers inured to war are capable of doing." Arriving at the Anse de Foulon, they found the beach unguarded. The French commander had been so confident that the British would not land there that he had sent the 40 men who should have been guarding the beach to a nearby village to help with the harvest. Wolfe himself landed from the first boat. His men then cleared away the felled trees and bracken that the French had used to hide the track. Then Wolfe and a party of 24 light infantry scaled the heights. By dawn, 4,500 British and American troops were assembled at the cliff top. Wolfe formed his army up on the plains into a single line of battalions, with two battalions in reserve and two companies forming a rear guard against Bougainville, who was dangerously close to their rear. They possessed just one light gun that they had managed to hurl up the hill. He positioned himself on the right line with the 28th foot. When Montcalm saw that the British formed up in battle order on the plains behind him that morning, he sent out 5,000 of his garrison to give battle. The governor of Quebec only allowed him to take 3 of the guns from the city's ramparts. He did not even wait for Bougainville and his 3,000 men to be recalled, but instead decided to attack the British line. He formed up his army with regular French regiments in the centre, battalions of Canadian militia on either side, and Canadian skirmishers and Indians on the flanks. The battle began on Wolfe's left, with a savage fight between the skirmishers and the force composed of the British Light Infantry and the reserve regiments under Brigadier Townsend. Meanwhile, the limited artillery pounded the centre of the opposing lines. The French regulars advanced, and the British regiments, who had been lying down to avoid the fire, rose up. The French fired at too great a distance, and their fusillade was ineffective, although one stray bullet hit Wolfe on the wrist. As the French advanced, the British withheld their fire until the range was 35 yards. They stopped and fired. Sir John Forte said that it was the most perfect fusillade ever fired on any battlefield, which burst forth as if from a single monstrous weapon from end to end of the British line. A second volley destroyed the French line. The Highlanders and the Redcoats then charged at the French and drove them from the field. Wolfe was at the head of the 28th foot when he was first shot in the groin and then in the chest. An officer supported him so that his men would not see him fall. Then a group of soldiers carried him to the rear. He was lying there, mortally wounded, when he heard a soldier shout, "See how they run!" "Who run?" asked Wolfe. "The enemy, sir," said the soldier. "Now God be praised. I will die in peace," said Wolfe. It was clear that Quebec had fallen. Wolfe ordered the 28th to march to the bridge across the St. Charles River in order to cut off the French retreat, and then he died. Montcalm had also been hit while attempting to rally his troops. He rode back to the city so that no one could see he was wounded, then he too was carried with the retreating throng and into a house where he died. He was buried in a shell hole in a convent in Quebec. Brigadier Townsend took command of the British forces and rallied them to fight off an attack from Bougainville to his rear. He went on to take the city in the afternoon of 17th of September. The Union Jack flew above the citadel in Quebec and the French formally surrendered the following day. Casualties were light compared to the other battles between the English and the French in North America. The British had lost just 630 men and the French 830. In the following year, the French surrendered in Montreal, and the Treaty of Paris was signed. The French ceded all their American colonies to the British. With the hero of the Battle of Quebec, General James Wolfe, dying during the battle, aged just 32, this has left historians to speculate just how differently the American Revolutionary War might have turned out if he had lived. And that's it for this week's battle. I have got a little bit of time to deal with some feedback here around last week's discussion of New Zealand history, especially the New Zealand Wars from the 1860s. So listener Jordan Milburn writes in, and I quote, "On the land wars, I think the attack vector you took on the show attempting neutrality doesn't really address the problem. The problem isn't the historical matter itself, which is exceptionally complex and belongs in a university-level history course, but rather that the Jacinda government attempted to impose a new curriculum as a way to build identity as New Zealanders in a country which is increasingly incoherent. The problem of history education is giving a context for how a person born into a society found their place and to feel their place amongst eternity. And the issue with a multiracial and multicultural society is that you cannot explain why people belong if the origin story is of a racial conflict between a settling people and an Aboriginal people. So after the Christchurch massacre, aware of the melting pot boiling over, the regime and its court academics felt they needed to impose a unifying identity based around an inclusive, watered-down Maori culture through social engineering. And this included the AstroTurf campaign to promote learning Te Reo, the replacement of simple English words with their Te Reo equivalents. Notice how that has disappeared after the Jacinda tyranny had its spine broken." End quote. Well, thank you for those insights, Jordan. I will raise the issue of New Zealand's lack of its ability to develop a stable demography in the weekly roundup. That part of the equation certainly hasn't changed. But yeah, this is a key item that I did not mention last week, and that's sort of how the revisionism of history is led by the requirement for diversity and inclusion, and just doesn't really make sense. Right? And the very important question whenever you're reading history or studying history is to ask yourself how you fit into that equation. And definitely when it comes to educating children in your country, you always teach the history from a unifying perspective to create a coherent identity for your country. And I mentioned this many months ago in a panel discussion, but also I think I'll say it again because it was in Croatia that I realized, you know, reading their history that, you know, and it was a recent history against the Bosnian War, there's obviously very heavily slanted to the Croatian side of the story, and that's on purpose. And that's important for them to do as well. It's not like, you know, they're going to promote a neutral view of the history that they fought in. And a friend of mine mentioned to me recently as well about, say, Japan. If you go and read Japanese history on World War II, it's obviously going to be framed in such a way to strengthen Japanese identity. And you're right, that's a really big problem that we have in New Zealand, is that there's a less and less reason for people to care about New Zealand history, because it's sort of like, well, it's not my history. I think that's a really, really big problem. And certainly my own interest in New Zealand history has increased largely due to having children, right, who should have this as part of their identity. When I was growing up, I did not care as much as I care now, because I felt like it didn't really matter so much to me. And now, you know, formulating a New Zealand identity is something that I feel very strongly about. Jordan also had some interesting points around the Maori Party and John Tamahiri fraud allegations, and I'll just read out a little bit of this as well, where he says, "I think the regime media and the elements of the state want to turn down the Maori nationalism stuff that was allowed to flare up during the Jacinda regime. They don't want a deep recession, ethnic tensions, and global geopolitical tensions at once. So expect to see more articles in the mainstream outlining corrupt practices from these NGOs. The NGO sector is a place where the regime can fund its clients without the regulatory oversight of the public sector." So there are lots of these out there. He says he's identified at least 20 where the executives paid themselves as much as 50% of grant money back in 2020. Like, wow, that's quite brazen and bold. But let's see if the predictions from Jordan hold up. This is definitely a good attack vector, as these far-left extremists use this taxpayer funding to reward their friends. So these so-called extremism researchers, Jacinda's Christchurch call, and so on, a lot of this really is just money laundering contracts to NGOs. So as always, I appreciate the feedback from all of you listeners, so please keep sending it in. Before we are joined by William McGimsey for this week's roundup, enjoy this piece of music by 18th century composer George Frederick Handel. the hornpipe movement from his Water Music Suite of 1717 was written in response to King George I's request for a concert on the River Thames.
You're listening to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dira De Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss the happenings of this week in New Zealand and abroad. And it is now the 24th week of the year. We're pretty much halfway through the year. The solstice is next week, middle of winter. It's great to be here with you, William. And how have you been in this past week?
Oh, I've been good. Yep. I'm always pretty good, do I?
We had a little bit of feedback on last week's roundup that I would like to address now. When I say feedback, I meant more a correction of sorts from a foundation member. And Christopher writes in here saying that he's enjoying the interviews with you, the weekly roundups, but he mentions that you said, and I quote, "The treaty settlements are now coming to an end," and I did not correct him. So he's put in a complaint about that, and I'll just quote what he says here. "Putting it kindly, that's wishful thinking. More accurately, it's woefully ignorant. Are you both not aware that due to recent very loose judicial interpretations of the Maritime and Coastal Act, a Pandora's box has been opened for newly defined ongoing Waitangi Tribunal settlements? The courts are now granting to iwi and hapu a restored right to ownership of New Zealand's coast and a few miles of the seabed beyond the high watermark, which is overturning the previous sales of the land to previous governments and non-Maori, a violation of citizen property rights. These claims," he says, "have ballooned to almost 10,000. So when you spoke last week around the Waitangi Tribunal settlements, I guess, what did you mean, and how do we put this in the context of the types of claims that are ballooning out of control and what you may have been referring to?
Yeah, well, the Waitangi Tribunal is, you can divide it up into two types of claims, the historic land claims and the more contemporary claims, many of which are on disagreements with government policy, such as the inquiry that's going on into the prioritisation of English over Maori in the public sector. So I was referring to the historic land claims. And when you look back at those historic land claims, I was looking at information from the Waitangi Tribunal today. They have, of the historic claims that have been lodged, they have settled a majority of them now. And the ones that they have settled constitute 83% of New Zealand's land area. So they have kind of broken the back of the historic land claims. But the man who's written the letter there, he's correct. The foreshore and seabed stuff does open up a whole new vista of potential property claims in the Waitangi Tribunal, and it could go on forever, actually. That's what I was trying to sort of bring attention to. That.
Yeah, and on this show, and like in my, I tend not to want to derail conversations that are ongoing with little nitpicks, some people are going to say, well, that's not a little thing, that's a big thing, you should have said something. Because I did think when you said, oh, they're Waitangi Tribunal, you know, the claims are being wrapped up, I thought you were referring to the land claims, but I had at the back of my mind, I had this thought saying, well, the tribunal is basically set up to deal with contemporary issues, as you mentioned, and as we talked about last week, that it has a very strong incentive to keep finding new problems, because the entire point of the tribunal existing and its remit to deal with ongoing issues, issues that may be these so-called treaty breaches that may be caused in the future, means that everybody who's employed by the tribunal, everyone who's involved in this process, is incentivized as a matter of keeping their job and making money, is incentivized to just keep finding more and more problems, more and more claims, more and more breaches. It's set up to go on forever. And it's an issue that the coalition government really ought to address. And they have said that they're going to address this, at least in part, in their coalition agreement. So we will keep an eye on that. Unfortunately, there's not much movement on that, as far as I can see from the coalition government.
Well, they have made some public statements, and Shane Jones has made some public statements, and members of the ACT Party have also agreed that there does need to be a sort of review of the scope of the Waitangi Tribunal. So I think they are looking at that. And let's hope that that continues.
And this is a good opportunity to give a bit of an update as well. I think one big item that's had a number of updates from last week has been the investigations that have now been launched into the Maori Party over what went on with the Auckland electorate here, what they did with the stats data and the various allegations that were that the electoral law was breached by treating, basically offering people food to come and vote and to do all sorts of political campaigning that may have been in breach of the Act. So, and then beyond that, the number of allegations on government departments that took, you know, gave deals, gave contracts to John Tamahiri's organizations. And of course, he's very heavily, he basically is the Maori Party. He's the president, the big man at the top, the guy who's pulling the strings of all of these different organizations. So could you give us a quick update from your perspective, like what's changed in the last week in terms of this situation?
Well, a number of investigations have been launched. So we knew that Stats New Zealand had hired investigators to investigate what's going on. And in addition to that, we've now got the Privacy Commissioner investigating, and we've also got police have agreed to investigate if there's been electoral breaches. And also Prime Minister Christopher Luxon's announced that the Public Service Commissioner is. So there's a number of government departments are reviewing the way they've interacted with the Waipurua Trust, Manurewa Marae, and these other various Maori organisations, and how they've handled their data, whether they've kept the data safe. And the Public Service Commission investigation is going to sort of look across all these different public sector organisations to make sure there's a degree of independence in the reviews that are being undertaken there, and to give the Prime Minister and our elected representatives some sort of indication of whether the public sector as a whole has behaved itself correctly with regard to data and the way they've interacted with these Maori organisations. So my feeling is that the public sector is a bit too keen to be seen to be working together well with Maori organisations, and they're a bit reluctant to be too tough on them for fear of being seen as racist or being called racist. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all if they've been a bit too lax in the way they've handled their interactions with these organisations. And there are sort of unconfirmed allegations and rumours circulating on Twitter of things like the Ministry of Social Development, for example, going along and also doing stuff at Manurewa Marae and offer, you know, and getting people to come along and doing treating within sort of days of the election. So they're all working together very closely with these organisations, and I'm not sure all the proper safeguards were in place.
And there's obviously a lot at stake for them, because the I guess the trust in the institutions themselves by the broader public are being eroded by these allegations, and obviously within the Maori community itself, or these various communities, they basically aren't going to be particularly happy that their interactions with these departments are basically conducted through what will be seen as, I was going to say bribes, but yeah, treating is the word that's used here. And the fact that their data is basically just being harvested, which kind of seemed to be an initial reluctance. So it's often said, well, Maori are more reluctant to engage with the government because they don't trust the government, because the government's betrayed them and lied to them and let them down. And now it seems like this is being done on steroids, but through Maori service providers. So it's like the middleman, the Maori middleman has been added in to still, you know, do these same things to them. From their perspective, this will be seen as quite a big betrayal potentially, and cause further erosion of participation of from these communities in government plans and government initiatives.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that the government was trying very hard to do some very good non-partisan things, encouraging, improving the census uptake among Maori and encouraging them to come along and get vaccinated. It's debatable whether people think that's a good thing, but
Yeah, that's it. But, you know, from the perspective of these institutions in particular, they've been trying, like they've been working hard to get people to do the right thing, quote unquote.
But yeah, but because these organizations have mixed up partisan and non-partisan things, and then they don't have enough separation between the partisan and the non-partisan operations, and then, yeah, they've just, the allegations at least, are they've taken the data and used it for electioneering purposes. And not only that, involved, you know, they're doing this treating type stuff, which is basically a form of bribery. So not good stuff.
And Philip Crump has also basically brought out further allegations this week, saying that the candidate, or the who's the MP now, to Kuitia Kemp, we'll just call her Miss Kemp from now on, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce her name, the Maori Party candidate and now the MP, was seen at the Marae polling station several times on election day in contravention of electoral laws, and also that party-branded clothing was worn by workers at the voting booths. So these are more, you know, big bombshell allegations, in particular around the behavior of this MP. She still hasn't been stood down, or you know, the Maori Party has basically circled the wagons, gone fully defensive on this, saying that they've done nothing wrong, that this is a witch hunt against them. And they've even called on the government to kind of lead an official investigation, which could be seen as a positive thing if they're claiming, well, we want an official investigation by the government. We want the Prime Minister to launch a more official investigation and quash these allegations. But yeah, it seems like almost every single day that we're getting kind of another bomb dropped into the mix.
It's a drip, drip, drip. And it doesn't bode well, actually, given that they've recently declared independence and they're going to set up their own parliament. Now to be being investigated by the so-called Pākehā Parliament. If that investigation finds that things have gone wrong, that's potentially a very divisive situation.
Yes, well, how the tune has changed in just a week and a bit. Now, we've had some movement on government policy this week. Perhaps a key announcement around what farmers or certain farm groups have been lobbying for has been the removal of agriculture from the emissions trading scheme. At least that's been the headline announcement from the coalition government, that agricultural emissions will stay out of the emissions trading scheme. Could you explain, I guess, briefly in a simple way for people to understand what that actually means?
Businesses that are inside the scheme have to buy permits, basically, tradable permits for the emissions that their business is calculated to emit into the atmosphere. And so it's sort of like a business cost. There'll be some sort of calculation scheme for a business, you work out how much your carbon emissions are, and you have to buy a permit to be allowed to emit that much. Farmers won't have to do that if they're excluded from the scheme. So many farm inputs will still be included in the scheme. So they'll be, you know, on your diesel, on many of your farm products that you buy, your transport costs, all that stuff will be included in the emissions trading scheme, and it will be a component of the input costs that farmers are paying. So they'll still be included in that way. But basically the rationale for this decision is that New Zealand farmers are already very carbon efficient in comparison to the other farmers overseas. And so forcing them into the ETS will just reduce their production because they'll have this additional expense of having to buy a permit to emit. And that what that will mean is that the production will decrease in New Zealand and it will increase overseas, with the result that total global emissions will actually increase because of the overseas farmers are less carbon efficient. So that's the ETS part of it. But there's another component to this announcement, which is around something called He Waka Ekanoa, which is a separate process that was going on side by side, trying to calculate on-farm emissions and have some sort of pricing scheme for them. And that's also been abolished because it was sort of a consensus-based initiative, and they couldn't really reach consensus very easily. So the new government's abolished that and set up a new pastoral sector group involving the farming lobby groups and levy organisations to try and figure out a way of taking account of farm carbon emissions. And that's the way they're going to do it moving forward.
So the Green Party, I guess, especially is not happy about this. As you mentioned, ETS is if implemented in the way that the previous government set it up to be, or rather they adjusted it, I believe, to get farmers included, because the National Party had previously excluded farmers, if I remember this correctly, would effectively result in CO2 emissions increasing around the world. So it's not really about reducing CO2 emissions then as the for the Green Party. The whole thing, rather, is you think they're basically just openly making it out that, yeah, it's about a tax. It's an extra punishment. It's an extra attack on business. They don't seem to be, you know, what's the angle for the Green Party on this? Why do they want farmers to be included if it's pretty obvious that doing this would result in increased CO2 emissions around the world?
Well, it's really about meeting arbitrarily set and defined targets. New Zealand as a whole meeting sort of arbitrarily set and defined carbon targets that we've sort of agreed to in various international agreements. And in order to meet those targets, they want as many sectors of the economy, including agriculture, to participate in, you know, reducing their carbon emissions as possible. Even if that means global emissions go up, so that, you know, it is a bit silly. It's managing to the target, not to the real outcome.
Yeah, exactly right. So it's all really for the Green Party. It's about the fact that we did our part. That's really what it's about. We did our part. We can say that we did our part, and who cares about, you know? And then we're going to somehow magically force everyone else to do their part. Really, which, you know, putting the whole dispute about whether or not CO2 has any effect on the climate changing, whether the globe is getting hotter, putting all of that aside for a moment, it really is the fact that, but yeah, it's just purely about these international agreements, and they want us to be able to say that we did it, we reached the agreements.
I think it's part of the agreements, but it's also, there's a desire from within the Green Party to think farmers, among other businesses, are, you know, environmental villains anyway, on a number of reasons, not just the climate, in terms of water quality, also in terms of things like animal welfare. And they're not happy about farmers, full stop. And also the political opposition. Farmers are, in New Zealand, have traditionally been supporters of the Conservative government. And there is a tendency amongst people on the left to try and disempower their political enemies financially and in other ways. So I think part of it is that it's punishing the farmers, trying to take away an industry and a lobby, or weaken an industry and a lobby in a constituency that is opposed to what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. It's like the Green Party really, at a subconscious level, understands the what's called the friend-enemy distinction from a German philosopher Carl Schmitt, where it's about politics is about rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. And the Green Party seems to be particularly good at that and focused on that. And sometimes on the more conservative side, we kind of, I guess, miss that point, that really that's for a lot of people is the aim of politics. And in actually, maybe that ought to be the aim of politics, in the sense that, you know, we often get these so-called right-wing, center-right, conservative governments, and they don't actually really put very much effort into rewarding their voters and doing things for the people who have given them power. So at least a positive thing then to see that the National Party, and in conjunction with ACT and New Zealand First, is actually delivering for something that a core voter group, a core lobby group that's backing them, actually delivering something that they've campaigned on. So that's a positive in and of itself.
That's right. And it's not, there's another announcement this week also related to farming, and that's the announcement of a inquiry into rural banking. Although it's an inquiry into all banking, but with a rural emphasis. So the Commerce Commission is currently doing some work. It's already released a draft report into competition in New Zealand's banking sector. And the government's announced a review to follow on from that. Federated Farmers have been lobbying for a review into rural banking for quite some time now. They've got survey data that says that there's been a sharp uptick in the pressure being applied to New Zealand's farmers by their banks. And they've identified a consistent interest rate differential between farm lending and residential mortgage lending. And there's also some other complaints they have around, for example, the closure of rural bank branches, which makes it harder for rural communities to interact with banks. But a lot of farmers are boomers, I hate to say it, and so the computer banking might not always be as good as the in-person banking. So if you close down the branches, that can have an impact. And the other issue there is a lot of banks now are signing up to and implementing various types of green and sustainability and environmental targets. And the allegation is that the banks have all collectively signed up to these green targets. And it's sort of, if they're all doing it, there's no option to borrow from someone who's not doing it. So it's a form of anti-competitive behavior. So that is potentially another thing that this review will look into. But perhaps the key issue is that the Commerce Commission has identified as the Reserve Bank's capital requirements. So banks are required to keep a certain amount of the loans they loan out on reserve and not lend it out. So it, as a safety sort of function. And the thought that the Commerce Commission is putting out there is that perhaps this is stifling competition in the banking sector and creating an unlevel playing field between smaller and larger banks. The Reserve Bank seems to think that these requirements are needed to ensure the safety of the banking system. So we'll see how that plays out. They've had a big week for farming, I think, this week.
Yes, I see it mentioned that I'm working on a coalition tracker. I haven't done this week's update yet, but coalitiontracker.nz. One of the items I'm tracking here is that this banking inquiry is something that they promised they would deliver. So that's something that can be checked off that they're doing this now. And I see as well that it's being run by two committees here, the finance committees and the primary production committee. So they'll be doing this joint inquiry together. And there's not much to be said. I don't know how long these inquiries take and whether or not this is going to be or risks becoming the Labour Party's equivalent of working groups, where they set up this committee to investigate this, and then like just goes on forever. So I'm assuming here they have a plan and they're actually going to do something. As you said, this is a key thing that Federated Farmers lobbied for. Again, this is an important political group that's supporting the coalition government. They want to be re-elected once the term is up, and they'll need these voters to support them again. So they'll have to deliver something, I would say.
Yeah, I hope so.
And of course, if they don't, well, then they'll lose. You know, that's what happens to governments. If they don't, give their voters a reason to turn up again, then that's it. Then it's over. On the next political issue here, we've had this month's update, but it's the numbers that we get here are usually about a month and a bit behind. So the immigration numbers that we have now available for April, and the updates, you give an update on your Twitter account whenever they come out. So I guess if you want to run with the numbers, the update that you've sort of prepared, and I'll fill in any details and ask any extra questions.
Well, last time I gave this update, we had record numbers of New Zealand citizens leaving, and this month we've broken that record again. So it's there's a gross figure and a net figure, and both are records. So 81,000 approximately New Zealand citizens chose to leave the country. It's about 56,000 net, because a certain number of New Zealand citizens came back. So record numbers of New Zealand citizens leaving, also record numbers of recent migrants leaving the country. So those are the two big groups of people who could possibly leave, and they're both at record levels. Yet nevertheless, the net migration is still at 98,500, because we're bringing in such large numbers of people. The gross number of arrivals is 229,000, something like that.
And just to be clear for the listeners here, this is from April to April, so April 2023 to April 2024, all these figures over the space of that year.
Yeah, that's right. I'm giving year-to-year figures. There's also monthly figures, which we could get into as well. But year on year. So the takeaway is huge population churn, near record numbers of people going in and record numbers of people going out.
And this is part of what you call the great replacement update, and something we've discussed. If people are interested, I'll mention it again. The first interview I did with William was on the great replacements. You can find that on RCR, the great replacement discussion on what that means. But basically, as you've said, it's basically as what you're describing here, the deliberate immigration policy to bring in large numbers of people to basically replace either the children that people aren't having or the fact that your citizens are leaving. So you've got large numbers of New Zealanders leaving, and the economic policy, the immigration policy is basically we'll just replace the population and just keep, as we're seeing now, it just keeps going. It just doesn't stop. They keep doing it year after year after year, successive government after successive government. And there's very little talk about it in the mainstream media, very little talk about it from economists, when it's pretty obviously like a massive indicator or has a massive impact on social factors and economic factors in the country.
Yeah, no, I'm not claiming that the policies they're introducing are deliberately designed to have record exodus of New Zealand citizens, but I think they are deliberately designed to bring in record numbers of people. And yeah, as you say, the Great Replacement is just the name for the demographic decline of white people, the reduction in the white proportion of the population that's going on in all Western countries as a result of mass immigration and also lower birth rates.
So you mentioned monthly figures, and I pulled these up because people have asked, saying, okay, well, the National Party made a bit of an announcement. Erica Stanford, Minister of Immigration, in February said she'd be making changes, tightening up visa numbers. I was looking at the raw arrival numbers, the gross figures for about 20,000. Just shy of that, 20,000 for April, and they were 24,000 in February when she made her announcement. So this is like a small decline, but it's hard to tell if the government has actually made changes to visas. I mean, 20,000 people a month is still a very large number of people. As far as I can tell, that would still equal over 240,000 people a year if you have 20,000 people arriving, and that's like 5% of the population of the country every single year. So it's hard, as far as I can tell, there's not been really any change made to just the numbers that we're seeing from the current government, because obviously when we're looking at yearly figures, half of that is still the previous government. I'm seeing no indication that the government's made any particular any impact has been made, but perhaps you've got a slightly different view on that.
No, I think you're probably right. I can't see any impact. The numbers are coming in monthly are still very high. Of course, the numbers going out this month were also very high. But
that's why the net gain, if you look purely at the net gain, it's only 2,200 only, I say. A net gain of 2,200 wouldn't be considered to be massive, right? If you were gaining 2,000 people a month, that's 25,000 people based on these numbers. Of a net gain. That's actually what I remember doing an interview with the economist Michael Riddell a few months ago, and he sort of suggested 20,000 is a reasonable number from an economic perspective of people coming in a year. But the catch here is that the gain, ideally you're not losing 18,000 people a year. It's the same thing. It's 18,000 people a month, which is the largest number of people in one month ever. In terms of those departures, of 18,000, 60% were New Zealand citizens. And that is, the largest loss of New Zealand citizens to overseas destinations for a long-term basis. Perhaps people do often come back to New Zealand, but not in numbers like that. The largest loss of citizens in one month. What do you think is going on here with government policy, economic policy? What's causing this massive exodus of New Zealand citizens?
Well, I think the economic conditions, mainly. New Zealand's in a recession now, I believe, or at least a per capita recession.
Yeah. Well, you talked about this last time. They fudged, again, immigration, they're fudging the numbers and saying, oh, we had 0.1% GDP growth. Well, the only reason you had 0.1% GDP growth is because you brought in just like, to 100,000 people, 200,000 people. But yet per capita, we're definitely in a recession. Have been for, I guess, close to a year.
Yeah. To be charitable, there is a chance that, and I think this is probably not true, but there is a chance that some of the departures, the migrant departures, are actually due to tightening up and visas and following up and prodding people to leave. But given that there's such a large number of New Zealand citizens that have also left, they're not leaving because of that reason. So it's they must be leaving because of economic reasons. And so it's likely that the migrant departures are for the same reason. One policy that the government has actually passed, which could be prodding people to leave, is the elimination of the first home deposit subsidy. One of the main reasons, and you look into the data for why people leave the country, is to buy a house and to start a family. And that subsidy was actually something that was of practical use that could have helped people get onto the housing ladder. So I don't think that's the main reason people are leaving. The main reason is just the general economic conditions.
We have a little bit of a lag with figures like that as well. Like, I think when they announced that it was going to be stopping right away was last month, which we're kind of just, I think it was last month, was it in May? And we're only dealing with figures from April in terms of record leaving. So if we see these numbers increase when we get the ones for May, the ones for June and so on, we'll definitely have an impact. Interestingly, house prices are currently declining slightly. So yeah, it's definitely has been a key reason, but I feel like there's got to be something more going on now, which, yeah, perhaps it's the tightening up of the job market and so on, or just better opportunities overseas, because at least on paper, the housing market is in decline for the first time in a while.
When you bring in a large number of people, that can prod some of the existing people to leave because of the effect it has on demand, not just the house price demand, but for rental properties, rental demand. So people often say, you know, we need to bring in these people to replace the people who are leaving. But often bringing in the people is one of the factors that's prodding people to leave because of the effect it has on the rental market and the job market as well, and things like that.
Sticking around these on the subject of the government and their performance, overall stability, recent polling indicates that the government is perhaps losing a little bit of support. At least primarily the Green Party seems to be polling well. It's hard to know how much you put into polling at this point. I think it maybe gives an interesting indication as to how well people are receiving the government's policies, but especially if a government is doing things that are unpopular early on in its term, and then it tries to focus on winning re-election in a re-election year. What do you think of the overall polling situation? You know, which I think all but one poll has basically pointed to the fact that the government, if an election was suddenly held today, the coalition government would still have a majority. I believe that's the situation. But there are indications, especially with Christopher Luxon's favorability, that he may be quite unpopular or getting more unpopular rather than more popular as he's, you know, getting into the role.
Yeah, well, there's the one Mikey Sherman poll where she made a big deal out of that one poll result that showed the government might not make it back in, especially because New Zealand First wouldn't have made it back in and then they couldn't have put together a coalition government. But the rest of the polling suggests that the government would have a smaller majority, but it would still be able to form a government.
And I think it's the negativity, like you think about the immense amount of negativity, constant media barrages, protests that are organized by Greenpeace and so on. Like, there seems to actually be a lot that you would think would be driving down polling numbers with just our wall-to-wall negative coverage, but it's not sticking to the point that I think that they're hoping it is.
Yeah, well, I think you would have to, looking at the polling numbers, I would anticipate that the negative, the media's run a concerted campaign to try and paint the new government negatively and destroy any chance it has of a honeymoon period. And in addition to that, there's been quite large protests from the from Maori activists. And also last weekend, we saw quite large protests from the Green and environmental activists protesting against the government's fast track bill and protesting against also the announcements that have gone on around mining and the reversal of the offshore oil and gas ban. So I think those are the big headwinds for the government. It's navigating those, the race-based Maori protests and the environmental protests. I think the one of the things that might be driving the Greens upwards is Chloe Swarbrick, and she's not popular with me, but I think she is popular with other people. And so if you look at the TPU Curia poll, you see that Labor, I think, is down by 3 and the Greens are up by 3. So it looks like there's a bit of transference of support from Labor to the Greens in that poll. But you're right, Luxon's popularity, that's a big problem. The media often focuses on the sort of the point man, the most popular person, and tries to bring them down. It seems to be the tactic, to, you know, direct all your firepower onto the bigger target at the front. And that seems to be having an effect, I think.
One of the things you mentioned in that one negative poll for the coalition, which would have seen New Zealand first out of parliament, that it seems unlikely based on other polls. So I actually went back and I looked at what did things look like, you know, 6 months into the Labour New Zealand First coalition in 2017 to 2020 polling. And they actually basically by this point were polling below 5% consistently through to the end, you know, until the election, until they got out of
New Zealand First.
New Zealand First, when they were in the Labour coalition. I'm looking at the numbers now, and their numbers are looking pretty healthy compared to where they were sitting at their Labour Party coalition. So that's something that they may be looking at positively, in that they've learned to their lesson. They've managed to create, you know, they seem to be putting in a lot more effort, at least to shore up their base or deliver to some of their donors in a positive way, you know, at least when it comes to mining and so on, and not clearly when it comes to immigration, as we've discussed. So yeah, hard to tell if that will hold up in the next years, but I could just say to people listening, based, you know, ignore all of the negativity. And if you look at the historic example here, they're doing much better than they were in their previous coalition deal.
Well, that is the pattern for New Zealand First. They spike up in support around election campaigns, and then they fade into obscurity during the term of government. So it's not, that's normal for that party.
And is there a bit of a concern that the focus of the government is a little bit off? I guess the protests that are coming from the left, but you may say cultural issues largely, some of them economic issues, and with New Zealand heading into a recession, is there a risk here that they're not focused enough on the economic side? Or are the, you know, when the tax cuts kick in, everyone's life is going to get better? What are we looking at for the rest of the year? Are things just going to get tougher? Because then that'll get tougher for the government as well. People will blame the government, saying, okay, it's been 6 months, it's been 12 months, and the economy is getting worse.
Yeah, well, I think there is a certain, I think the mainstream New Zealand voter, if we were to call them that, I think the famous rule of it's the economy, stupid, probably applies for the majority of New Zealanders. And given that we are in a recession now, the fact that the government support is holding up has to be viewed as a positive. And I would anticipate as the economy improves, which hopefully it does improve, and maybe that might take a while, but hopefully by the time of the next election, the economy will improve enough that will bolster the support of those sort of, you know, the Kiwis in the middle. And then you've got the New Zealanders who are more animated by some of the cultural type issues, and election campaigns are normally what fires up those sorts of people. So there is reasons to believe, I think, that even if there is a sort of lull in support for the coalition government, that it might be recoverable by the time of the next election.
And I had one other thought just now, very briefly, was that one of the things that may be helping the government out actually is the Māori Party, basically the race-based issues, where voters are looking at the potential, as they were in the last election, of having, you know, what does a Labour Green Māori Party government look like? Is it, you know, race politics? And there seems to be some, you know, the fear of New Zealand turning into just race politics all the time. It's very, very real among a lot of voters. So
yeah, the Māori Party, a bit of an albatross around the potential, I mean, the coalition of chaos. They've turned around that coalition of chaos term, and they're using it for the National Party, the National Act, New Zealand First Coalition. But originally that was the name for the potential Labour Greens Māori Party coalition. And you can see why they would throw that with the Māori Party in there, couldn't you?
Yeah. I don't think it's going to stick for the current government. I mean, the things actually look to me quite stable, looking at the issues that they're delivering on, look at how they interact with each other, looking at how their supporters are interacting with each other. I see things are quite stable with the coalition government. So I think the so-called chaos or a coalition of chaos simply won't stick on this government. And one final thing then there, I also like to say that I'm hoping that media outlets like Reality Check Radio, like RCR, breaking into the monopoly, breaking the one party, the one media party system, the united front that the media has, that we are making a big difference there as well, and actually providing some kind of balance, actually providing the other side of the story, and that that's going to have a big impact on the New Zealand political landscape in the long term, where you don't have all the journalists basically creating one narrative together and deciding how they're going to shape the country. So that's a very, I'm going to pat us on the back there and say that we're doing our part.
I think so. I think that's right. And not only Reality Check Radio, but just the social media and online ecosystem in general. If you go and look at the surveys that are put out on where people are getting their news, more and more people are getting their news and information online and from non-traditional sources. And different sorts of views other than the mainstream left-wing view are available on those sources. And that can only be helpful.
And we now have about 5 minutes left for international issues, which is a great way to wrap this up. Big one in the past week, and it's rapidly developing, of course, so we'll touch on it as much as we can. But the European Union had elections for the European Parliament, and there were some big wins for right-wing parties, especially in Germany and in France. I believe some of the results, many of them are still provisional or exit poll results. I'm told that the results will be finalized by Monday or Tuesday our time. But it doesn't seem like the people there are expecting a big shift. So we can say that with some confidence, there's been a big shift there towards the right. And the interesting thing is that the younger voters very much are turning to the right. The 16-year-olds have been allowed to vote in European Union elections in Germany, and about 30% are, or maybe it wasn't that they've allowed them to vote, I think, but they may simply have done like mock elections in schools. Can't quite remember the details. They may have the same issue still with, like we have in New Zealand with the left arguing that 16-year-olds should be allowed to vote. But anyway, at least the younger people are showing up, at least over 30% supporting like the Alternative for Germany party, supporting Marianne Le Pen in France at the National Rally. Big decrease in Green Party support among young people in Europe, and big support for right-wing parties, big support for nationalist parties. Yeah, it's a very different political situation there compared to New Zealand.
Mm. It's largely immigration-driven, but also a backlash against some of the climate change and environmental policies. There's been large farmers' protests over in Europe. I think that explains some of the decrease in the Greens' support. And perhaps the biggest thing that's happened as a result of this is what's happened in France, where French President Emmanuel Macron has called a snap election. And now there's a real possibility of some sort of right-wing government involving Marine Le Pen's National Rally, if she can cobble together enough support on the right, forming a right-wing government that does something about that immigration problem. And what we've heard today is that the French Conservative Party, the party of Charles de Gaulle and Jacques Chirac, has agreed to form an alliance prior to the elections with Marine Le Pen's party. And this is sort of it's an important moment because they had been pursuing a sort of the gentleman's agreement of trying to exclude the right-wing parties up until this point, the so-called far-right parties. And now they've gone against that rule and they've agreed to do a deal with them. And that may be enough to get them in, or it may not be. It's sort of a borderline. So they'll be scrambling to find enough support.
Yes, many European countries have had these agreements basically to exclude the quote-unquote far right from politics altogether, and they would just form national unity governments or whatever's needed to keep them out, or they would just ensure there was absolutely no way that the so-called fringes could not be those vulgar right-wingers, those far-right extremists and so on, the racists, etc., the Islamophobes, the Islamophobes, and on it would go. And that, as you've mentioned, has changed. And a number of factors are in play there, which have also caused complaints from the right, is that you see kind of almost a more attempt to moderate a number of positions as well. I believe Marine Le Pen and National Rally have kind of tried to mainstream themselves. But I see that more, I see that as quite positive, because even if they've moderated their policy, the propaganda that's deployed against them is still, oh, they're far right, they're extreme, and so on. So it normalizes the fact that someone like Marine Le Pen, like National Rally, can be brought into the mainstream. They can form a coalition or at least campaign agreements with major, or the old right-wing parties, the old conservative parties that have collapsed in Europe. And then you also see other parties now popping up, like further to the right in that sense. Eric Zemmour in France, I think, is the guy, and his I'm not sure how to pronounce it in French. It's like a Reconquista, but French.
I couldn't help you if that.
You can't, right? I'm sorry, my French is terrible. It's one of the subjects I failed at school. But it looks and basically you've got now National Rally saying, oh, no, those guys are too extreme. But yeah, Eric
Zemmour has agreed today not to stand in the French elections to ensure that he doesn't take support away from the National Rally, so that a government, an anti-immigration government, can be elected and do something about the problem. The other thing to note is that some of the mainstream conservative parties, and even some of the left-wing parties, have actually agreed to, I don't know if moderate is the right word, but they've come over and agreed with some of the so-called far-right positions on immigration, for example. So if you look at Denmark was one of the few countries that didn't have gains for the far-right parties. But the reason for that is because the socialist parties in Denmark have adopted largely the immigration skepticism of the far-right parties. And so the people were willing to go back and vote for the socialist party as they adopted
those policies. I've seen the claims that basically all of Europe, the socialist parties in Europe could have permanent majorities if they wanted, if they just adopted anti-immigration positions. And they won't do it. For the most part. But yeah, you mentioned Denmark. I'm actually going to try and do some interviews with some guys from Denmark in the next little while. Don't know if it'll happen next week or the week after, but it'll be great to get an update from them on that particular issue, because I've seen that as well, saying, hey, the left is actually able to maintain a lot more ground, and it's because of their anti-immigration positions they've picked up as well. Now, quickly, in 1 minute, a UK election, have you got any comments, I guess, updates there? I don't believe much has developed in the last week, other than that Reform is continuing to gain in the polls. Nigel Farage is continuing to do well. I haven't spotted anything else that's worth mentioning at this stage. I think the interesting stuff is still a few weeks away.
That's right. The only thing that's really happened there is that someone threw a rock at Nigel Farage. He seems to be, he's been milkshaked now. He's had a rock thrown at him. That sort of physical violence is only going to help him win his election campaign, I think, or do well in the election campaign anyway.
Yes, it's. I don't see that as a negative for him. And yeah, it's often the case that violence used against popular or rising political figures tends to really help them a lot. So I actually would expect to be seeing less of that, simply because his opponents will realize that they'll just make him more popular. I do hope he remains safe and that nothing worse happens, because obviously that would be terrible for him. Even if it ends up being good for the country, it would be terrible for him, and we wouldn't want that. And I think we can fit in one last quick international issue, which is the Hunter Biden conviction that's been announced this week. Again, no sentencing yet. Same with Trump. We're waiting perhaps a few more weeks for sentencing. What's your take on the Hunter Biden conviction? Because they basically had, I think, 170 crimes they could have prosecuted him for, and they didn't. They prosecuted him for something very specific, three charges related to lying on applying for a gun license or something, acquiring a gun when he had a prior drug issue, something like that.
Yeah, he didn't declare he had drug problems on the form to apply for his filing.
Yeah, so this seems like it's a very, I don't know, there's lots of conspiratorial angles you could take here that may well be justified.
Well, he did. There's lots of other things. You're right. Like,
well, there's 170. So I checked. There was a report that was on 170 crimes they had identified, and then the department, the attorney general, decided to prosecute just that one particular point out of the 170 crimes.
Hunter Biden, there's a lot of corruption type allegations. So they've got him on something unrelated to corruption and political corruption, and unrelated to his father. I mean, so just for example, it's just one thing that happened. He was appointed to the board of Burisma, which is a Ukrainian energy firm, and he has no experience in energy at all. So it just seems like a pure, I'm the son of the president, appoint me to the board, you've got access. Well, he wasn't the president at the time, but I'm the son of the politician. Appoint me to the board, and then you've got access through me to a very important political figure in the US. So there's a number of things like that that they haven't mentioned, they've shut down to try and, I think, distance Joe Biden, his father, the president, from the allegations. But one interesting thing to me here is that you've got this going on while Trump has been prosecuted. So the system seems to have this interesting way, almost as if it's self-aware that it needs to project itself, project the appearance of neutrality. So it has these, and it's not the only time something like this has happened. This is sort of a pattern that I've picked up where, and when you have one important political figure prosecuted, the system seems to have other things happening on the other side to present the appearance of it being neutral. That's a conspiratorial angle for you anyway.
Well, that's what I was thinking too. And that's sort of, yeah, to legitimize their conviction of Trump. And they may try and, people are now saying, oh, they're definitely going to try and throw him in prison now, because they can say, oh, you can trust the justice system. It's fair. You know, the president's son has been convicted of some crime. And so it's all fair because, you know, even though the crime that Trump supposedly committed was beyond the statute of limitations, and they went and changed the law so they could go back and then they could prosecute some paperwork that he had potentially filed incorrectly, I'm still not entirely sure that anyone understands what actually, you know, what the actual crime was. And then to try and present this as balanced, I don't see it working. So that's why the anti-conspiratorial angle is just that it's unrelated. The system itself is falling apart because people aren't going to bite and say, oh yeah, suddenly I now believe that the legal system is reliable again, because once you start to look at the details, the whole thing, like the idea of balance, completely falls apart as soon as you investigate any of the details in either of these prosecutions.
Well, I mean, it just seems ridiculous that someone so close to America's president is, and a lot of the allegations and the rumors involve Joe Biden himself, things he's done earlier on in his life. It just seems ridiculous that, you know, the president and the president's family could be involved in such sort of corrupt and really not just corrupt, but sort of bizarre activity.
And a lot of it is open evidence for it, right? They had a laptop, Hunter Biden's laptop was leaked. And thankfully, I never saw any of the contents of it, but you see people discuss the contents of it. And quite disturbing things, I won't repeat, but yeah, that, and they seem to, and it's not like they've been, these allegations have been refuted in any way. It's just purely been ignored. The whole situation seems insanely bizarre to me, but that's just how the American system works and how it has worked probably for quite a while. And it seems that, yeah, things have got to a boiling point now. And yeah, there's the election is going to be very interesting, just to put things mildly, but yeah, there's, it feels like things are getting to a point in America where the system is not able to keep up appearances, and they're at potentially a real point where they're going to have to where something is going to, the wheels are going to come off quite suddenly, and it's hard to predict what can happen then.
Yeah, well, all those conservative arguments that people like me keep making about the importance of the social fabric, we're seeing what happens now when you don't take care of the social fabric. You get very divisive elections, and you get people who don't really want to live in the same country as the other people who are living in the country with them. Your elections become more and more, they resemble more and more a civil war, slowly and surely marching in that direction. So not good developments.
All right, well, with that negativity, we'll call it for today. Thank you very much for joining me again, William, and especially on these international issues. They will simply continue to develop in the next few weeks, and who knows, we may get more positive news as things go on. But that's all we've had time for. Thank you, everyone. Please don't hesitate to text us at 2057 and email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. And that's it for this week's roundup. And if you've got important comments for us, we'll be sure to include them in next week's show. Thank you, William.
Thanks.
And to the listeners, we will be right back after this break.
We do this because we care for honesty. We care for the future of this country, of our children and generations to come. You know what? It's more important to be noisy than nice.
Rate bills in Southland this year talking 20% rate increases on 20% a couple of years ago. It's out of control. The redistribution machine is completely destroying the energy of productive people.
The problem we have today is that governments are pressured by mainstream media, big money, special interests, and international organisations. These organisations that seek to shape our society, to shape the way we live to suit their agenda. It's something we might call a compliance model.
We used to pay 50 cents for the Herald every day, and that's when we got the news we wanted. When you stopped paying for the news, the advertisers and the people behind the news organisations started paying for the news. So you can see that definite behavioural shift, which is whoever's paying you is what your messaging is going to be.
Some people out there enjoy the left and right division, the debate, the fighting. But I, for one, don't see that as a productive way forward in creating a future for our tamariki. You can argue until the cows come home, but people right now are so strong in their beliefs, so finding that common ground, that common overlap of left, right, woke, awake, is vital to any melting pot of a nation.
We're going through this information revolution. We've got the internet now, so all this information is there. And I always say to people, look, we went down there thinking that we were fighting for freedom. But the bigger picture on that is that they were really fighting to keep control of information. You know, that's what it's actually about. These controllers of information are losing control because information's become like water now. You know, you block it here, it'll pop up somewhere else.
They keep telling us that democracy is dying because of the media companies. But you know, they've sat there smugly telling us how to live our lives for, as far as I can remember, thinking they're the smartest people in the room, but they didn't see this coming.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, or even if you don't agree with what you're listening to, then get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057. Or if you'd rather email us, you can at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so get in touch with us now.
It is now time for This Week in New Zealand History. We are right at the end of the show. Very quickly, the first item is the origin of a place that I visit often here in Auckland. On the 11th of June 1901, John Logan Campbell handed over the deed to the land around One Tree Hill to the Duke and Duchess of Cornwall and York, later to be King George V. They were touring the empire to express gratitude for the support in the South African War. The land was named Cornwall Park in honour of the Duke. The top of the hill contained the site of a Maori pa, and later an obelisk was built there as a memorial to the Maori, and John Campbell's body was buried next to it. On the 12th of June 1902, the following year, the New Zealand flag was officially confirmed as the recognised flag of the colony for general use on shore within the colony and on all vessels belonging to the government of New Zealand. It had been in use on ships since 1869. Two more bits of trivia for you here. In 1959, on the 15th of June, the produce company Turners and Growers announced that it would now export Chinese gooseberries as kiwi fruit, which had been grown locally for nearly half a century. They were introduced to this country as seeds brought back from China in 1904 by Mary Isabel Fraser during a church mission trip. And then on this day in the 14th of June 1984, New Zealand's most famous snap election was called by a slightly tipsy Prime Minister, Robert Muldoon, who had been the Prime Minister for 9 years and left a long-lasting legacy in New Zealand politics. When a journalist commented that a month won't give you much time to prepare, he answered, "But it won't give the opposition much time to prepare either." As it turns out, Labour leader David Lange and his finance minister Roger Douglas did not need that much time and swept into power a month later. The rest, as they say, is history. There's no dedicated mailbag segment today, but I have interspersed some of the feedback throughout the show, and rest assured that I do read all of the little notes and comments that you send to the inbox and on social media as well. That's all for today. On behalf of the RCR team, thank you very much for spending another week listening to and interacting with all of our shows. The replays will start at 4 p.m. and continue on until breakfast, with Paul Brennan returns on Monday at 7 a.m. The final piece of music this week is once again by Japanese film composer Joe Hisaishi, and this one is called A Town with an Ocean View. So you can try to imagine that one as you listen to this serene orchestral piece. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon and evening, your weekend, and Lord willing, the dialogue will return next Friday.
Thanks for tuning in to the Dialogue with Dewa De Boer. You can catch the dialogue replays on our website at www.realitycheck.radio/replays.